Members, settle in just a minute here. I think we have a quorum. Thank you, members. And with that, I would like to call to order the committee hearing for Human Services Finance on March 20th, 2023. And we do have some minutes from 3:16. Has anyone read the minutes and would you like to approve them? We have a volunteer.
Madam Chair, I would like to move approval of the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. We have moved the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the ayes have it. And with that, we are going to dive straight into our first bill today. Congratulations and welcome to the committee, Chair Noor. We have House File 2215. If you would like to go ahead and move the bill before the committee and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 2215 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Madam Chair and members, I have DE1. I'd like to move DE1 to put the bill in the shape of that I need to discuss.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have House File 2215 before us to be laid over for possible inclusion. If you want to go ahead and present your bill.
I'd like to move.
Oh, I'm sorry. We do have an amendment. My apologies. And we've moved the DE before us. Is there any questions or conversation to the DE in order to get it in the shape the author would like?
Madam Chair.
Representative Baker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just maybe does the author want to explain the DE before we accept it, or do you want to just make it as a part of your presentation? Sometimes it helps. Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Beck, I think adopting the DE because the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion will be in order if you will allow me to proceed with the explanation once the DE is adopted.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Baker, for that question. All right. And with that, all those in favor of adopting the DE amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
All right. It looks with one nay and all in favor, we will say that it has passed. And with that, it is now in the shape you would like it. Mr. Chair, if you would like to go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2515 addresses an issue that has been before us. The issue is when we transitioned small settings to become an assisted living licensure. Then we followed up and said, well, they may not have the appropriate setting. So the department came up with a plan that we ended, we put a moratorium for small assisted living settings. And then we allowed folks who have got smaller settings to transition to CRS, which is the corporate foster care licensing. So this bill essentially, because the sunset to transition is June of the coming month, the coming June. So this extends, and we're making sure that those smaller providers can continue to provide care in a different setting. Madam Chair and members, I do have a testifier who will go through and explain some of the bill.
Thank you. If you want to go ahead and state your name and your affiliation for the record and proceed.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Shakaya Richmond. I sit on the board of directors for Residential Providers of Minnesota. So RPAMN, it's a 501c6. It's a nonprofit trade association that represents small residential customized living and waiver service providers in Minnesota. We were formed in 2021 following a series of massive changes to the regulatory and reimbursement landscape in which our members operate. RPAMN has roughly 200 provider members and subscribers, with the vast majority of them being BIPOC-owned, culturally specific service providers who might not otherwise be engaged in the policy development and legislative processes. We are here today to testify in support of House File 2215 and provide some historical context and firsthand experience for the committee to consider as you all work together in this legislative session. RPAMN has testified in front of this committee on multiple occasions this session about the hundreds of BIPOC-owned culturally specific residential service providers we represent have been overlooked and neglected in the recent years. We've been boxed out of providing community residential settings, or CRS, since the implementation of a licensing moratorium in 2009. In 2019, we were dragged into an assisted living licensing system that was never intended to apply to the single-family homes and other small residential settings where we serve our clients. But worst of all, in 2021, customized living providers servicing individuals on the CADI and BI waivers were the only category long-term care or home and community-based service providers expressly excluded from the medical assistance rate increases passed in response to the COVID-19. Today, our members are on the brink of collapse. The bill before you today, House File 2215, is one small step towards ensuring that individuals with disabilities in our BIPOC communities can seek culturally specific residential services and live in the settings of their choosing. The bill does two things. First, it seeks to change the temporary moratorium exemption that was created in 2021 to remove significant barriers that stand in the way of our culturally specific service providers successfully enrolling in the program. For example, as you heard from DHS when they presented their budget request, the DHS licensing division is completely overwhelmed, and it is taking nearly a year for a provider to secure a 245D license needed to make the CRS transition. Further, because the existing exemption is tied to the individuals receiving services and where they are residing as of July 1st, 2022, the licensing delays have resulted in providers either being unable to take new residents for fear of losing their eligibility or making the transition with a reduced capacity that puts their economic viability at risk. As amended, House File 2215 removes some of those barriers in an attempt to streamline the transition process. Second, House File 2215 increases rates for customized living providers servicing individuals on the CADI and BI waiver in the line with what it is supposed to be for the EW program. While we were understanding the desire to reduce the cost of the customized living program, the human impact on our BIPOC-owned service providers and the members of their communities they served during the moratorium exemption process cannot be understated. In summary, RPAMN is here today representing hundreds of BIPOC-owned culturally specific disability service providers who are struggling to comply with the requirements of an assisted living license that was never intended to apply to us, while trying to navigate broken licensing and enrollment processes to transition into CRS via the moratorium exception, all the while being the one collection of services providers who were expressly excluded from the last Bynum's rate increases. We believe that House File 2215 is a starting point as we work with you all to find a resolution to this problem during the 2023 legislative session. Absent significant legislative action, RPAMN's members will continue to fail, leaving thousands of Minnesotans of color without the ability to receive support from providers in their own communities. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I know here at the legislature we often talk about unintended consequences, and certainly it's unfortunate that sometimes we have to come back and right those wrongs. So thank you for being here to testify. With that, members, is there any discussion or questions for the bill? Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Knorr. I have a question, and it's just I just want to understand, because my lane has been seniors in long-term care and assisted living, and I've had people reach out to me who are currently in the 24-hour customized living, which I understand that. They were in the assisted living model, but they have like 6 residents to 14 residents. They serve the CADI and the developmentally disabled. And my understanding is the direction was to move them either to, I believe it's CRS, or to ICS, which is more of the apartment style. But their concern was that if they wouldn't have access to elderly waiver funding, in the same way. Do you know if this addresses those dynamics for the providers of disabilities and
Madam Chair, curious. So just to go back a little bit, when we transitioned the small residential settings to the assisted living licensure, that meant that we were not able to continue doing that. We put a moratorium for small assisted living licensure with less than four residents. What we came up with is to allow those smaller settings to move to community residential settings, providing BI and CADI waiver. So that was the intent. So this bill just extends the moratorium to the exception that is available until December, but it also allows the setting to have individuals who have been there before July 1, 2022. For the question of the elderly waiver, I think the department can help us clarify that. I see Chris is here.
I think we have Ms. Brom here who can speak to that. Hello, Ms. Brom. If you want to go ahead and state your name and your post for the record, and go ahead and proceed.
Madam Chair, Christy Brom with the Department of Human Services. Representative, I think your question on elderly waiver, it's my understanding that this underlying amendment does allow people on elderly waiver to be able to use this exception. When it comes to integrated community supports, that's not a service that's available on the elderly waiver at this time.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the testifier at DHS. That was my question, because I think the hardship was with the CRS moving into that wasn't the issue. It was assuring that they would be able to access the continued funding with elderly waiver for the clients to be in that, because in the apartment model that wouldn't work and they wouldn't really be applicable for what they don't have an individual room, and those small models don't offer that. So it makes sense to me they would be in CRS. It's just making sure the funding mechanism isn't inadvertently some of the unintended consequences would be that, and so just making sure it matches. And so I just wanted to make sure I was understanding it, mm-hmm. and that was going to follow. So thank you for getting that done, because it's going to help a lot of the small providers for sure.
Thank you. All right, and with that, any other members have questions? Well, Mr. Chair, you must have done an exemplary job. We have no other questions. And with that, if there are no other questions, Mr. Chair, would you like to renew your motion to lay this bill over?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I renew my motion, House File 2215, to be laid over as amended.
All right. Thank you. All right. And we'll move on to Chair Noor. Are you coming back?
Chair Fisher,
the bill is next. House File 1811. Please move your bill, Mr. Chair, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1811 to be laid over, and I do have an A1 amendment that I would like to also have moved. And the A1 amendment changes the dates to move it out from when we originally had it. It would change the dates instead of having it by 2023 to 2024. Otherwise, it's kind of like we're having to do things before we even get the bill get things approved here. So that's why I would ask for the A1 to be adopted, please, to get the bill in the shape I would prefer.
Chair Fisher moved A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The A1 amendment is adopted to your bill as amended, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, appreciate the opportunity to present House File 1881. It's a bill that helps address the situation that we have many great nonprofits out there that like to use a lot of volunteers, but they're challenged. Volunteers provide basic human services to underserved populations, And volunteers are an asset with skills, talent, time, and energy to help sustain and even expand services and nonprofits. Yet most organizations don't have the resources, support, or direction to make this happen, and particularly smaller nonprofits, some of those that have been first starting out. This bill would provide funding support to support those organizations, mobilizing volunteers to help underserved communities, populations suffering or at risk of homelessness, poverty, hunger, lack of access to health care, etc. A grant administration and selection committee would be part of the process of the organization receiving this. They will determine final distribution guidelines and make grant allocation decisions. And primarily the grants will be taking a look at underserved communities and with specific emphasis on Greater Minnesota. I will stop there. I do have a testifier with me today.
Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, great afternoon, everyone. My name is Nyla Abair, and I am currently a MAVA board member, and I'm so pleased to be here with all of you today. But first, shout out and hello to both you, Representative Noor Chair, and the rest of the committee. So pleased to be with here with you today. So, again, my name is Nyla Abair, and I'm here to encourage you all to pass the volunteerism bill, House File 1811, onto the omnibus bill. And as Representative Fisher stated, it's all true. Everything he said is true. We know the importance of volunteerism and what the outcomes of volunteerism can do for all Minnesota communities. I've been a staff and volunteer for Girl Scouts for over 15 years. And I've been on the MAVA board for over 7 years and have held the role as board chair. I'm currently a board member for Nexus Community Partners, and my day job is Chief Strategic Engagement Officer for the African American Leadership Forum. In each of these roles, volunteers have played a critical role in our work. We all know that Minnesota nonprofits support communities who lack resources and lack access to resources. The impacts of volunteerism can be easily seen in any community. You drive down the street, you see your food pantry, or you see a place for the unhoused. But you can see that now. But what will be the impact on our communities without this investment? Did you know that volunteerism also reduces teen drug use? Yes, one of the things that maybe we don't all see, but it happens. And it clearly did happen in Becker County. In 2021, we had a testifier here for the volunteerism bill sharing the impacts that MAVA's work had on Becker County. Becker County concluded a needs assessment to determine what are their needs in their county. And they found that at-risk youth was the biggest need. And with support from MAVA, they built the first and only youth center. And the funding from MAVA... That's good information, too. And the funding from MAVA has transformed the landscape for Becker County youth. I mean, just think about it, how instrumental these micro-grants or re-grants can be for small organizations and institutions. But this is only one example of MAVA's work. The beauty of MAVA is that they focus on rural and BIPOC organizations of whom they find and allocate funding to support, and they continue to support so these organizations can scale up and use volunteers in an innovative way, which of course makes long-lasting impacts on their community. As a MAVA board member, I've seen MAVA's growth and increased ability to scale up organizations that are the real boots on the ground. Organizations such as VEEP, the United Way, and Becker County Community Services, and others. As a testament to MAVA's expertise and effectiveness, MAVA was recently awarded federal funding to do this exact work and to help organizations. Ooh, you don't know I'm in a meeting. Okay, stop that. My bad, people calling me too. So,
that's all right.
MAVA was recently awarded federal funding to do this work, which will help organizations meet the outcomes that are needed to change lives. Yes, everyone, nonprofit investment can change lives. As the Chief Strategic Engagement Officer at ALF, we also see the needs of small but impactful nonprofits and the aspirations of our community and importance of investing in the nonprofits serving the citizens of that community. Investing in nonprofits and their infrastructure benefits not only that community, but the people outside of that community who have a model for change and for success. And it immensely increases services and can increase staff and volunteer capacity, which means we all win. So I urge you all to say yes and move the volunteerism bill, House File 1811, to the Human Services Omnibus Bill. And please know that not only myself, but I'm sure many people in this room who are volunteers, who support nonprofits, are extremely grateful for your time, your intentions, and your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Discussion members. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Fisher, for bringing this bill. Quick question for the testifier. So what other organizations, when you talk about infrastructure and the influence that MAVA has, what other places would you subgrant to?
That's a great question. So,
go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. That is a great question. We have granted funds to other small organizations that we've identified, again, such as the United Way, I'm not sure what city, as well as VEEP, which is a food insecure organization. Now, with this grant, we'll be placing more of a lens on what are rural and BIPOC organizations. So we'll identify them, and it'll be really based on their size, their need, and really understanding what's going to take to allow them to have more, increase their scope of service or the outcomes that they have. I don't know if that's answering your question.
So
just one quick follow-up with that. Having an understanding of, you know, where things have gone, what is the mission or the focus of MAVA, you know, in the future now, if this goes through $1 million of taxpayer dollars, and when you talk about the size of even rural areas, is it based on population? And when you talk about need, things like that, just curious what the scope of the focus would be for 2023-24. Going forward.
Actually, I was going to defer to my testifier here first.
Thank you.
Like, go ahead.
Thank you. So though that information, I believe, is included in the grant guidelines that gives a little bit more detail and description of what our vision and what our plan is in terms of how we'll use the grant dollars and what are the criteria for those organizations. I will say, just as being a board member and hearing some of the conversations, there have been organizations that have been brought up, such I'm thinking about even, Juxtaposition, Arts Us. These are organizations that are serving youth and, offer opportunities for them to, of course, not be in places and spaces where they could get into trouble or, you know, do things they shouldn't be doing. But I wish I had more detail to give you around that. But I know that there are grant guidelines that have been developed. I just.
And thank you, Chair Noor, Representative Gilman. When they go ahead with the granting project, they're going to be evaluated in a number of different areas or put together a number of ways, and scoring will be done based on evaluation and planning from the organization. So who's ever applying for the grants, as for the sub-grants, would put together a work plan, looking at the effectiveness of the work plan. Are they leveraging resources? So in other words, have they got matching dollars coming in? That will be part of the scoring process. So all these things will be part of the matrix, the capacity and financial strength of the applicant. Taking a look at what the community impact is, how sustainable is it? This is something that would go away after 1 year. And this would make a difference, too, is in the final report, is being able to come back and say, hey, we're able to do this, but these are the ones that need sustainability going forward, and we will lose these going forward. So this will be part of the report that will come back to us here at the legislature. What is the collaboration that's going on? So who are other partners that they're bringing in? Are there businesses, schools, you know, finding out who those partners are that are going to help, particularly with providing the volunteers that would be coming in. They'd be looking at the geographic distribution, and then finally the diversity of the communities that are scored. So they'd be having this matrix that they'd be using to help figure out where it would go to make sure that they're looking at it in a holistic way.
Thank you.
Representative
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Fisher, for this. So at a really high level, we're trying to give leadership training to volunteer organizations around the state of Minnesota. High level. And with that, does MAVA then have the ability to and the authority to or the responsibility to manage the folks that they're leading and training? And if they don't do it appropriately, or again, I'm envisioning we're not paying people because they're volunteers. We're paying for leadership. We're paying for maybe it's tools, maybe it's resources, things like that. Mm-hmm. What if we find someone out there, some group that is not doing what they said they were going to do? They did nothing about running a project they were at hope to do. What is the clawback? What is the, I guess, you know, it's a risk anytime we do something like this. But I'm just looking at that end. I'm kind of saddened that we have to do this kind of thing because volunteerism, I know, is shrinking. And we have to find a better way to capture them. But also, it's all about good leadership, too. So I like the idea of this. I'm just trying to get my head around how do we make sure that if we're going to give $1 million to an organization to lead this effort, how then are they going to be responsible to make sure that they are able to, do they have the authority to retract, to pull in, to say not again? Just how does that work then for MAVA? Maybe that's a question for your testifier, but we're getting into some challenging waters here.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative Baker. When I take a look at how this will be put together, is that the organization itself would take a look at what is the capacity of the smaller people that they're working with out there. And I've seen two ways that it's been done. Sometimes you're dealing with some organizations who are very, very small. They're not able to put those dollars out in advance. And so they have to have in smaller dollars is being able to say, okay, if you have a smaller organization that can't do it, we'll give you the money up front, but then we're going to expect to see supporting documentation coming back into us. At the same time, also looking for feedback, if there's a certain dollar level that you folks feel that we should maybe be calling out or trying to sketch out, would want to make sure that we have that input now so that we can make sure that's incorporated in. What I've been used to with other, you know, as and having been in a nonprofit, that, you know, where we receive small ones, large ones, et cetera, there are others where they do is reimbursing. If you've got an organization that's larger and has a cash flow capability, it's usually done is where you then submit the grants after, you know, for reimbursement afterwards. And so that's not called out specifically in here, but if there's some comfort language that you'd like to see, more than happy to help develop that. And maybe that also might be part of what we might want to see in the report. What are things that you'd like to see in there? And I'd be happy to take information and ways that can help make sure we've got that comfort and accountability and the flexibility, particularly these really small nonprofits have that don't have the cash flow that can advance things. Yes. Oh, yes.
Thank you as well for your question. I'm sorry. Oh.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And I can't see your name, so Representative, thank you for your question. If I could just also add a finer point. So this is work that MAVA has been doing, again, as a board member in supporting and leaning into this organization for the past 7 years. They've been doing this, but at a smaller scale because there hasn't been any state appropriation for volunteerism. And so thinking about if they're able to, you know, support an organization throughout that life cycle of using those funds, that's what MAVA has been doing. But, of course, again, at a smaller scale. So they do have the staff capacity. They do have the mental capacity. And again, they've already done this work. And so now with an actual investment and appropriation from the state, just thinking about what could be done. And so the $1 million, we all know, is a drop in the bucket. There are tons of nonprofit organizations across our landscape, and the ones that we can impact and really make them more effective and really make them benefiting our community. This $1 million paid by our taxpayers will definitely be worth the investment. So, thank you.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when I first look at this bill, I thought of, you know, North Minneapolis, I thought of community schools and how they're, what they do is are good at pulling and coordinating between a multitude of, you know, nonprofits and organizations so that they more effectively and efficiently provide broad services to the community. And I was curious about this Alliance of Volunteer Events. To me, I would hope that the organization was very understanding of the community, the needs, and the multitude, and was helping, the grant process discussions to be able to get that coordinated so you don't have duplication or overlap, because with especially a lot of our senior citizens have either moved or are less open to being out in the public because of the pandemic. And so not just the functionality of helping with the grant, but with the conversation and interaction with the groups to help everybody come together for the communities that they're serving. If you can enlighten me on how the organization does that.
And Representative, are you, thank cool. you. Yeah. And Representative, are you referencing community engagement? Is that what we're talking about?
It's community engagement, but it's having a coordinated conversation and periodic meetings with the different groups, and with, you've got the school, and you've got other local entities, government entities, and community entities to come together and talk. So one, more people know what's out there already, and more people understand what's missing and how they can be more compatible.
Ms. Head.
Thank you. Yes. So MAVA has for quite some time hosted affinity groups and opportunities for people within, again, our communities across Minnesota to tap in and, again, share their aspirations, share what their needs are, or what are the challenges that they're experiencing. And so currently MAVA has facilitated, coordinated, and orchestrated events in our rural space, but also for BIPOC leaders. And outside of, you know, being a space for training, they're also a space for capacity building. And so there's opportunities to stay tapped into MAVA, to have ongoing monthly meetings, whether that's bringing in someone externally from community, or whether that's just hosting a community forum so that they can be aware of what MAVA's benefits are, how are there opportunities that you can benefit from being a part of, the Alliance on Volunteer Advancement. And these things are posted widely on social media and on the website. So if you are in the field of volunteerism, if you're in the field of nonprofits, you go to MAVA. MAVA is the premier state organization for supporting volunteer management and volunteer engagers. And so when we think about engaging the community at large, whether that be a school or some other institution, a lot of times they're already members of the organization. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us, in the last 6 months or from last summer to now, the locations of some of these community forums? Because you said greater Minnesota, and that way we'd understand across the state what sort of has been done.
Did you want to get somebody else to help?
If I may.
We're going to phone a friend here.
And then we'll get to Chair Fisher to do the final.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carmeet Bowman. I'm the executive director for MAVA, and part of the reason I'm not testifying today is I don't have much of a voice, so I appreciate my board member here. MAVA is a membership organization with over 700 members. We are the collaborative organization. We are run by our members. We have members in every corner of the state. We do membership meetings, membership council meetings, affinity groups, and our members, like I said, are nonprofits that have no staff, are completely volunteer run to Lutheran Social Service, YMCA, and so on. So this idea, this need for community-based funding came from the members themselves, who said to us, we cannot organize ourselves without some funding. So for example, as Ms. Hebert said, a group of volunteers and nonprofits in Becker County did a needs assessment and asked MAVA for some funding so that we were able to bring them together to build an infrastructure for a youth center That's the core work of MAVA, to help organizations engage volunteers in an innovative and effective way. I hope I've answered your question, Representative.
I think he's looking for locations and places in the state. If you can follow up, I think that is...
Oh, I mean, yeah, I can give you specific names if you want locations.
For greater Minnesota, for the entire state. Yep. So I think we need to get the data of where the services are happening. We can follow up on that.
In short, Mr. Chair, there's no location in Minnesota where the services are not happening through MAVA. Our members are in every area of the state, every nonprofit. There's over 700 members at any given time. But we certainly can give you a list of where these activities are happening.
So we'll get the list and so that it's more accurate on the number of places that you're providing services as Representative Palm is requesting. Chair Fisher, with your closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I appreciate the opportunity. I hope that we will consider this in our funding process. So often this helps the small nonprofits out there. When I first started off working in the nonprofit field, we were extremely small. We didn't have the capability to be able to recruit the volunteers. And once we hit a certain threshold, the more volunteers coming in, the better we are able to do our services. And this is what this project would do, is allow for that funding to grow these nonprofits with their volunteerism. Thank you for your time.
With that, yeah. Chair Fisher renews his motion, House File 1811, as amended to be laid over. So the bill is laid over. Thank you so much, Chair Fisher. The next bill we have is House File 777. Representative Petersbeck, welcome to the committee. Please come to the testify table and introduce your bill. While you're coming, I'd move that House File 777 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your committee hearing this, and thank you, committee members, for listening to the bill. I think this is the third time I presented this bill over the years trying to get it passed, and we thought we were going to get it done last year, and then of course a lot of things happened, and so it didn't. This is a fairly simple bill. It's a one in which we're asking for a Class B intermediate care facility in Owatonna, the district that I represent, is needing an increase. It hasn't had an increase for I think like 15 years, and it's really needed in order to stay abreast with some of its needs. And we're asking for it to go up to $400 a day, which I think was what the agreement was last year for intermediate care facilities. And so that's a request. That would put them, I think, kind of in the middle towards the top half of the reimbursement rates that are currently right now. Currently, they are fifth from the bottom in reimbursement rates. And I will let my testifier really talk about the needs and concerns with this particular facility.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ashley Fredericks. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ashley Fredericks, and I'm with Kaplan Woods Care Home from Owatonna. Thank you for the chance to appear in front of you in support of H5777. Before I start, I would like to thank Representative Petersburg for his support in carrying this legislation. Kaplan Woods is a 16-bed Class B intermediate care facility, one of 118 in the state that care for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Our goal is to provide the same compassionate care and love to each of our residents that a wonderful mother or father would. Many of our residents don't have family members, so we are their family. We are known for taking on very challenging individuals with both behavioral and medical conditions and helping them thrive while making positive progress with both health and behaviors. To put the medical care in context, some residents we feed through G-tubes or we need to monitor 24/7 for severe conditions such as diabetes, seizures, COPD, and self-injurious behaviors. Some are blind and many have degenerative conditions in addition to mental health challenges. Many of our residents came from other care homes where the sending home gets to the point where they can't or just no longer can take care of the residents. As an example, one of our newer residents came on a short-term stay after breaking her ankle in the two-bedroom home she was living at in the time. After she returned home post-rehabilitation, she didn't want to get out of bed and at one point stayed in bed for 2 weeks straight, experiencing high anxiety and OCD behaviors, including not willing to go to the restroom and the actual bathroom. Within the first 30 days of being admitted to our facility, she had been flourishing in her new environment for more structure and increased social interaction with peers. She has gone from going to work on average of 1 day a week to working 5 days a week at a job that she loves. She uses the facilities regularly. Her self-esteem in regard to walking and life in general has improved drastically. Her old home was small with narrow hallways, which made her unsure of herself in her walking. Now she's able to walk longer distances in her home, which has large, wide hallways for her to move around and build up her strength. This is just one example of many of the success stories we've had serving residents. I'm here today to ask for a rate increase so we can continue to serve and be the family and community our residents deserve. Although we serve individuals with very high needs, our reimbursement rate is among one of the lowest in the state. A rate increase would allow us to hire more skilled staff, increase wages and benefits to existing staff, and upgrade our aging facility. Not to mention, with hiring more skilled staff, we are able then to get the residents that we currently have on a waiting list that are in desperate need of our services. The work we do is difficult and mostly thankless. We are sworn at, verbally and physically abused, deal with stubbornness, bad behaviors, smells, difficult family members, and a mountain of paperwork to document all of it, just to name a few things. We do it because everyone needs care, love, and a life to live a purpose. And that's what we strive for each of our residents. The best analogy I give you is that it's not just about the cost of care, but this is about the cost of being a family member. We are not just caring for our residents in the facility, but we are with them out in the community doing life. We are with them when they have to go to the hospital at 1 a.m. or require a trip to the doctor, dentist, or therapist. We get them gifts at holidays and work to make their birthdays special. There's so many things that go into what we do for them. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm exceptionally grateful for your willingness to hear our requests. On behalf of our entire team, we'd be grateful for your support. Thanks for your time and consideration today.
Thank you so much for your testimony and coming to see us here. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions? Well, I think they like your bill. So nobody has a question. For your closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you can tell, this really is an impact to the people that are there. And just to give you a range, this facility here is under $200 a day. The high, which is a lot of them, are at over $500 a day for reimbursement. So the $400 we're asking for is not to give us the Taj Mahal, but just to help with the personnel costs and other things that are there. I just thank you for consideration. I appreciate you listening to our concerns, and thank you, committee.
Thank you so much, Representative Petersbeck. I'll renew my motion that House File 777 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you so much, Ms. Fraser.
Thank you.
The next bill we have is House File 2087. Representative Beeman, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2087 to be laid over for possible inclusion. I know there's a discussion about a minor change, but please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing Bill House File 2087, which would help solve the dire situation that families who need home care nursing services are facing. Currently, members, we are unable to transition medically fragile children from the hospital to the home, as well as keeping children home once they get there, due to a lack of available home care nursing. While many children are remaining in the hospital and many families are not getting the support they need, we are creating additional costs in the system by millions of dollars that can be avoided. A study in 2019 found that the average delays experienced by nursing shortage were around 54 days. That data was refreshed in 2021 to show an additional 40 days to delay in the delay to get home. That's 3 months of unnecessary hospital stays that we do need to address. The significant delays in discharge that we are experiencing across all Minnesota hospitals is keeping stable patients from transitioning home while limiting the number of beds and rooms available for new patients. There is a solution to this challenge. It starts by recognizing the skills needed by these nurses caring for complex kids in the home. One day, these patients are in the NICU and the ICU, and the next, they can be in their home. These nurses are caring for patients at the highest level, but because they are working in home care now, they're paid 35 to 55% less than hospital nurses. Let's fix that, members, by increasing the reimbursement rate for home care nursing services by 55%. Pay nurses for their skill set, not the environment where they practice. And now, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from our testifier, Ms. Goodchild, please.
Ms. Goodchild, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. My name is Tiffany Goodchild, and I am the proud mother of and fierce advocate for our son, Carter. I'm here to talk to you today about how crucial home care nursing is to families like ours. He's not here right now with me because he actually has a nurse at home. It's the only reason I can be here today. I'm asking that you help ensure medically complex kids across the state of Minnesota have adequate care by passing the bill we are proposing. Home care nurses are critical to the health and safety of our son, as well as the quality of life for our family, and here's why. Carter was born with an unexpected massive brain injury, which resulted in irreversible damage to 90% of his cortex. He was not expected to survive. And despite having a shortened life expectancy, Carter continues to prove his prognosis wrong. His official diagnosis is spastic quadriplegic cerebral palsy, which leads to all sorts of medical complexities, epilepsy, chronic respiratory infections, G-tube dependent, neuromuscular challenges, and limited mobility, just to name a few. Of course, we are grateful that he is here, but make no mistake, this life is hard and has required much sacrifice. I have given up my promising career in special education administration to be Carter's primary caretaker. We weren't able to secure any type of home care support until Carter was 3 years old. It's important to understand after 3 years of constant caregiving while also raising other children, I was depleted. During this time, I was not able to care for myself because I didn't have anyone that could care for Carter. His needs require a nursing level skill set. When we finally secured this support through Pediatric Home Service in 2019, it gave me all the hope, but it has not been without challenges. We started with overnight nursing, but in less than 2 years, we cycled through 28 night nurses. Just as soon as we got someone trained in, they would leave for a higher paying hospital job. This left us with open shifts, insurmountable stress, sleepless nights, and broken care for Carter. It was common for our schedule to only cover 40% of the required shifts. In 2021, we made the decision to switch from overnight shifts to day shifts with our home care nursing team. When we have them, our team of nurses are incredible. They are the most valuable resource we have. When Carter is ill, which can be often, nurses provide the hospital-level care that only a skilled nurse can. Unlike hospital nurses, our home care nurses do everything related to his care. They draw up and administer medications. They implement his hospital-level respiratory plan using hospital-grade interventions. They monitor and respond to seizures, some of which are life-threatening. But most importantly, they keep him safe and comfortable. Without our home care nurses, Carter would have been hospitalized 8 times within the past 6 months. Instead, he's received the vast majority of his hospital-level care right at home. It's important to understand patients truly get better care when they can be at home. Carter is more comfortable and sleeps better, which only helps him recover more quickly. When we have nursing, I can step back and be his mom, not his caregiver. When our nurse is here, I have peace of mind that he's safe at home while also having the ability to be present with my other children. You see, home care nursing not only provides stability for my son's health, but also my mental health and the function of our family as a whole. Our nurses go to school with him, which allows the educators to focus on teaching him new skills rather than his medical cares. When he's not ill, the nurses respect and follow our philosophy of care. They keep his body healthy by using a variety of adaptive equipment. They keep his neuromuscular health strong by doing range of motion stretching daily. They help his cognitive development by using his eye gaze communication device. They are the difference maker in our family and in his life. It's the only reason that I can be here today explaining all of this to you. Unfortunately, retention has greatly impacted his continuity of care and the function of our entire family. Our schedule has fluctuated from 40% to 70% coverage this year. Our concerns with our turnover and retention are directly related to the inequity in pay. Home care nurses deserve to be compensated for the value and skills they provide. Ultimately, home care agencies cannot compete with hospital-level pay, and it's the kids and families like mine that suffer because of it. It needs to change. Home care nurses should be valued as high as hospital nurses, and their wages should reflect this. This increase of 55% will dramatically improve the ability of organizations like PHS to recruit and retain the nurses our children need and deserve. I'm respectfully asking that you approve SF-1830-HF-2087 to support the safety of our most vulnerable population and the Minnesota economy. Thank you for allowing me to share all this with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Fuchow, and thank you for sharing that with all of us. And do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Thank you. Good afternoon, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
All right, thank you very much. I'm Mike Shreve. I'm a pediatric pulmonologist with children's respiratory and critical care specialists in the Twin Cities. I've been a practicing pediatric pulmonologist for 26 years, and our group has one of the largest patient populations of children who are at home technology dependent, which includes breathing tubes and ventilators and G-tubes. And I follow more of those patients than anyone else in our group, so I think I actually am uniquely qualified to speak about this patient population. Most of what I was gonna say has already been said very nicely, and so I won't repeat all of that. I would just reiterate that there's a general nursing deficiency and especially home care, and that's what we really need to work on, and it does come down to pay, essentially. When these patients have to stay in the hospital longer or go to the hospital, they are crowding the hospital, they're crowding the emergency departments, that's where they have to go because they don't have nursing. They're complex patients, and as Carter's mother was saying, these nurses do everything. So when these children go to the hospital and are there for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 90 days, they take up nurses, they take up respiratory therapists, they take up pharmacists, they take up child life, they take up many, many other people that then cannot spend as much time with other patients. So when these children cannot stay at home, it affects more than just themselves, it affects other patients. Also, when there aren't enough nurses, or they call in sick or they're short, the parents do have to take up that slack if they can, and most patients will do whatever they can to keep these children out of the hospital, and I appreciate that they do that, but it impacts their lives. They don't get sleep, they can't work. Their other children have to suffer because they're taking care of these children all the time, and so the family suffers greatly, more so than just that one patient who is my patient, for instance. These patients, like Carter, when they're at home, they're at home to thrive. They're not at home just to survive. They're not at home to die. They're there to thrive. They learn. They go to school. They offer a lot more to society than just their smile, although sometimes that can be enough, it seems. But these children, many of them grow up and they go to school and they have jobs and they impact other people. And they do that because they're able to be at home and they're able to thrive and not be sitting in a hospital bed and have very little interaction. So decreasing ability of these patients to be at home, having decreased home care nurses affects everybody, affects more than just these patients. So I ask you to please consider this. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Do we have anyone else in the public?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Deb Lunick. I'm the care coordinator at the NICU at M. Masonic, M. Health Masonic Children's Hospital. I've worked there for 38 years. I have noticed in the last 5-6 years, we've had many more home care, kiddos that need home care. With the advancement of technology and medical care, we are able to save more babies, but these infants have complex needs at time of discharge. Many of them need ventilators and specialized equipments that need to need nursing skills to do. Home care agencies have a set reimbursement for their care and does not allow them to compete for hospital wages and benefits. Also, with the current nursing shortages, the hospitals are offering retention bonuses, they're offering sign-on bonuses, they're offering bonuses for extra shifts. Home care nurses are leaving home care and coming to the hospital because they are getting all of these bonuses. So home care nursing agencies just cannot compete with this. If the reimbursement would be increased, they'd be able to compete with that. It would be more cost effective to have these patients at home, in their homes, rather than the hospitals. These patients take up ICU beds that are needed for other, possibly other patients. And the cost of an ICU bed in the hospital is anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 a day. At least it's billed that way. So the amount that you would save having them in the home paying home care nurses would be immense. Our hospital currently has 12 patients between our PEDS ICUs and the NICU that could be home with their families, and rather they're sitting in the hospital, a lot of them requiring one-on-one nursing care because of the tracheostomies that they have. Creates capacity issues. We had huge capacity issues when the recent, I'm sure you've all knew the RSV crisis that we went through. We were having to turn away patients because we did not have ICU beds. So these are 12 beds that could have been used for during that crisis. Nurses in home care, they're like running a mini ICU. They're doing the same things we're doing in the ICU in the hospital. They need to have really good assessment skills to keep these kids out of the hospital. The hospital is not the place for them to be. They get more infections, all that kind of stuff. These nurses are responding to emergencies usually by themselves because if the families have home care, they're actually going to work. So they're at home. If something happens, it's on them. These babies all need, if they have a tracheostomy, they need someone to be awake with them 24/7 in case that trach gets plugged or it needs to, or the equipment fails. In a perfect world, we'd be sending these kids home with 20 to 24 hours of nursing a day. We're lucky if we can send them with a skeleton staff right now. Many of them don't have night coverage, so I know a lot of my families are staying up at night and then also going to work in the morning. It's not safe for them. It's not safe for their kids. On the closing note here, these kids are going to be much healthier at home. They get less infections because in the hospital, you're just open to more things. They thrive at home. Once these kiddos get home, we see them. The families bring them back, and they just are thriving. They're starting to walk. They're starting to roll over. They just do so much better. They also developmentally do better. In the hospital, they're in one room. They can't, especially with COVID, they cannot come out. They can't go to the playground. They can't go down to, we have this nice end zone in our hospital. So they can't go anywhere. So they're in one room. At home, they're at least moving around. They can do things. They can actually see family members. It was very difficult during COVID. A lot of these families, these babies never met a lot of their family. Mom and dad were the only ones that could visit. We had one family that went home, and the baby was 18 months old. The father's mother never saw her son hold that child until that child was 18 months old because they weren't allowed to visit at the same time because during COVID, you could only have one or two people at the bedside. So we still have babies that are anywhere from a year to 15 months old that haven't met some of their siblings. And in closing, these babies, they shouldn't be celebrating their milestones in the hospital. We just recently celebrated 4 one-year-old birthdays of all kids that could be home. So they need to be celebrating these things at home. They shouldn't be in the hospital. They need to be home with their families. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Member discussions. Seeing none, to Representative Beaman, I think there's a discussion about the dates because this is effective I believe June, effective July 1, 2023.
Mr. Chair, I believe July 1.
Yeah, so the conversation, I think we can check with the department. We'll have more conversation on this, but I just wanted to make sure that I note that the effective date should be January 1, 2024, or upon the approval of the federal waiver. So we'll discuss more since the bill is being laid over. We'll have more conversation in the meantime. To your closing remarks, Representative Bean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the argument's been made, and it's about better care for these kids and saves money as well, and we should do this. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I renew my motion that House File 2087 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. The next bill is House File 2141. Representative Norris, welcome to the committee. Please come to the testify table. I move House File 2141 to be re-referred to Children and Families Committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor.
Good afternoon.
It's great to be with you and the other members here in the Human Services Finance Committee. House File 2141 is a bipartisan bill that's about good governance and the state allowing our local partners to do their jobs more effectively. New county employees who will be administering programs like SNAP must go through a training from the Department of Human Services before they can begin working. However, counties like my county of Anoka are struggling to get their new employees through this required training in a timely and efficient manner. In fact, it's not uncommon for new hires to have to wait 4 to 6 months to start. And there are a number of issues that contribute to this. First, training is typically only once a month, so employees can only start around that once per month training date. Second, trainings are limited to only 20 seats per class, and this is for all 87 counties plus the tribes. So counties may have to delay hiring or training for new staff if a particular training is full. Third, counties can only reserve 5 of the 20 training seats, limiting the number of staff that they can onboard at one time. This bill would allow counties who have the in-house resources to do so to pilot providing in-house training for certain programs for 1 year. It would give these counties more flexibility in their hiring and onboarding process while then freeing up space in the state-run training for smaller counties that can't do their own training. And this isn't an issue that's just limited to Anoka County. I don't know if these were included in your material packet or your packet of materials, but we've got letters of support from the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, as well as St. Louis County, Wright County, and Dakota County. So counties from all over the state are experiencing these issues and want to be part of the solution. I think this is a common sense solution to a serious workforce and workload challenge for our counties. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've got a testifier to explain more about her experience in this bill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Leth, and I'm the Director of Economic Assistance for Anoka County. The hiring and retention of financial workers has been a concern for many years, but the concern has grown with the increase in work counties have experienced, especially during the pandemic, and with the restarting of health care renewals in our public health care programs, the need for counties to be fully staffed is critical. Under the current training structure, when a county hires a financial worker, they are required to attend training through the Department of Human Services to learn the basics of the program and to receive state approval access in the state systems. The training is typically offered one time per month and is capped at 20 seats for each training, and again, that's for all 87 counties and tribes. If the training is offered only one time per month, the training dates and available slots may not align with the county's hiring needs. This is a challenge when counties are experiencing multiple vacancies coupled with an unprecedented amount of work. There have been numerous times throughout the years when Anoka County has had to pass up qualified applicants because they had a conflict with the timing of the Department of Human Services training or there are not enough training slots available. Anoka County is not unique in this experience. Many colleagues in other counties have experienced the same issues when trying to fill vacancies and train employees. Wright County recently experienced a period where, due to various circumstances, they did not have staff who were trained in family cash or child care assistance programs. And when they tried to get staff into training, either the training was not offered or the classes were full. Anoka County currently has multiple financial worker vacancies. If we are limited to set training dates and a cap on how many training seats are available to us, we will continue to have vacancies for months to come. Many of the larger counties that do have the resources and interest to do in-house training already have an intensive training county training program for new staff that is done in addition to the DHS training. We also recognize that there are many counties that do not have the capacity to provide in-house training and rely on DHS to train new employees. By allowing the larger counties to train in-house, we will open up more slots in the DHS training for those smaller counties. So I'm here before you today in support of House File 2141. This one-year pilot would allow counties with the available resources the flexibility to fill staff vacancies so we can provide essential services to our community members in a timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Litt. And do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion, Representative Lesnicka.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. So would your county be able to then train other counties is what this is going to accomplish, right? So you could be like a mentoring, or is it just for your own county?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the initial vision would be for counties to train their own staff. We currently have enough openings within Anoka County to train a full large class. But I think we're open to discussion on how this would look. I know in Anoka County, when we do training, we're also training on our internal procedures and processes. So incorporating other communities or counties into that would be okay, but it would have to work through plans like that.
Representative Zelesnicka.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you. My only comment is just if there's opportunities to do, you know, peer-to-peer and mentoring between counties on DHS or in state systems that are uniform, that would be a great platform, I think, to use between counties. If one county has two hires and another has 10 and you have a knowledgeable person that hasn't retired yet that can pass that knowledge on, I have great concern of passing knowledge on to the next generation. So I think in regions, it may make sense within regions to peer-to-peer between counties to consider that. I don't know if it makes sense, but just an observation. Thank you. I think it makes great sense, though.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Norris, for bringing this bill. Curious, I'd gone to visit the county as well, and curious if the backlog from DHS, is that, were the trainings in person or were they via Zoom, or how many hours is the training in order to qualify? Like, that's a couple of questions I had.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, so the trainings since COVID started have been done virtually, and typically they are 4 days long. It varies depending on what they are training, but for example, the SNAP program is a 4-day training and it is done by Zoom or WebEx or some virtual platform.
Representative Gilman.
So then, thank you, Chair. Will you be doing your training? I'm guessing, because when I was at the county in Wright, when I went to Wright County to visit, they were all there. I mean, over 250 people were in this, you know, just new facility that were doing these certain things with the county. Just that one area, you know, of significance, but they had to be boots on the ground in person. Will your trainings be in person, or will they also be recorded and be available, you know, via Zoom or some other format?
Directly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Remember, we each county kind of trains slightly differently, whether it's in person or virtual. At Anoka County, we do have training rooms dedicated with about 9 trainers. And so we bring people on site for training. We also do some of our training over a virtual platform. So it would probably be a hybrid mix of that. If this is approved, we would receive approval from the Department of Human Services for that training. So we would anticipate we would take their training requirements and implement them at the county over those, say, 4 days or so.
Representative Gilman.
And so just one last thing is the counties that do participate in this program facing like additional funding mandates, will they absorb the cost or how will that work? How will the funding piece work for the counties?
Thank you. This does not have a fiscal impact. We would not take, it would not be an additional cost for our county or shouldn't be an additional cost for other counties who already have trainers in place and already do this training. So at Anoka County, we provide, say, SNAP training over about an eight-week period of time. So the Department of Human Services training is just 4 days of that eight-week period. Taking it on internally would not add an additional cost to our county.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we're going to do a pilot with the idea that we're going to expand across, I would think you'd want to include, a location near Mankato, Olmsted, which has Rochester. And I would think you would include, there are a few counties that group together for different medical offerings, and it'd be advantageous to have a county in one of those entities in greater Minnesota go through this so that then they could look at the small county that's already cooperating with others doing training across that cooperative service group, because if after the pilot everything looks good, then it's much easier to roll it out and more quickly across the state. And so I think that would make for a more complete and appropriate pilot bill. So I hope that as this goes through committees, that you look at that regional and also that size component, leveraging existing cooperation between counties in a service group or with medical plans.
Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, I might have missed this obvious question, but why are we limited to only 20 right now currently with DHS in this training module? What is limiting that at this time?
Representative Norris. Directly.
Thank you. I could also look to the department. Typically, when trainings were in-house pre-pandemic, they were limited due to class size. Now they are by, I believe it's Zoom or a WebEx platform. They require still a couple trainers from the Department of Human Services. So I think it's a resource issue for the Department of Human Services. They have people on that are training, but they also have people on that are helping those that are learning. So it may be a resource issue for the Department of Human Services, not having enough trainers there to open up more slots. But I'm not sure if
someone who went through that training more than 20 some years ago.
Me too.
It requires more intensive hands-on. I think there's a lot to learn in 4 days, so that means you have to be able to accommodate that small group. Okay. So it's more of a small class size, it's more intensive training. So when you go back to the county, you get the additional training. So this is just the top of the iceberg rather than taking the deep dive. I see. I think that's.
Well, and again, Mr. Chair, and again, to that point, I get it if you're in person. If you've got a classroom, you're set up for a certain thing, but now we're virtual. I'm having a hard time understanding why, because now we're virtual. And if we've got big screens and good microphones and capacity to kind of let more in the door because we're not now limited by physical space. I wanted to ask DHS, why is it now limited, though? I would have thought that one of the few things that came out of COVID that we can say is a little bit of an improvement might have been the efficiency model of delivering that important training. So maybe Mr. Burdick could help us with that.
Mr. Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. And to your question, Representative Baker, absolutely we've learned a lot and gained a lot of efficiencies during COVID and kind of learning how to do all of our work differently. And I think that's something we appreciate and see. As the discussion has sort of unfolded here, part of the challenge of keeping the class size small is really important is the complexity of this and the need to have adequate space for interaction between the instructor and the trainers, or excuse me, and the trainees, because this is really complicated things. We've got federal law requirements. We've got a lot of data privacy issues. This is handling very sensitive information in a very complex and frankly antiquated IT systems that require a lot of work. I know we've had a lot of conversation in this committee about how many, including my generation, has never worked on a green screen. And so you come in, you know, being steeped in an iPhone, and then you're looking at this computer system that looks like it's from another world. And so that is a really intensive need for that training. I do think we see opportunity, and we've been talking with the counties about building up our training capacity so that we can offer it more frequently. But that small class size, given the nature and the importance of this work, is really important.
Mr. Chair, and again, I thank you for that. But again, it just seems it seems that you're able to teach 20 virtually, and I don't know why you can't teach 40 virtually, because the intensity and the class sizes, I don't know if you're getting a lot of questions on the side. I get it that we have a horrible computer system, and but like Representative Gilman has said, at my county meetings that I had, they are very frustrated that the backup and the backlog has gotten so bad. Again, because there's been so much more turnover both on DHS side and the county side, a whole lot more training. But I've always felt that, you know, if there is 4 days of training with a larger group and if there's a little bit more follow-up because of folks that maybe fell behind a little bit, I would hope that we could find a way to expand that capacity because now it's not as physical. Or it's, you know, because it's still going to be clunky no matter what you do because it's the old computer system. I just think if we could do more at one time, it just makes more sense. So I know it's got to be more common sense than what I'm asking because it just seems too easy to fix. But it's I just think it's something that again, I support the bill. I like the counties having that pilot project. I just don't understand why we can't capacity, you know, grow that to some degree. So
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Baker. I would also want to add just that we are starting a continuous improvement project between the state and the counties to look at exactly these questions about how can we actually do a better job of this. And I want to thank Anoka County in particular and our county partners for raising this to the department earlier this year, and that kind of jump-started this work. So these are conversations that are happening actively.
Mr. Baric, when are we going to get the opportunity to go into the training room so that people can understand how the MAXIS system, the MMIS, and MED system, so they can have hands-on experience at least for a couple of minutes?
Mr. Chair, I've already gone through that training, and I don't want to do it again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks notwithstanding, we'd be happy to have a field trip for the committee this summer.
Okay, one of these days we'll go visit a training room at DHS and actually see how that system is.
Yeah.
All right? We've got a plan. Thank you so much. Any further questions? Representative Gilman, do you have any follow-up?
Okay, really, really quick. Thank you, Chair. Just for DHS as well, but I also just wanted to say that I didn't know if it was capacity for space because that building, you know, with central workers being teleworking from home, you know, of the 2,600 central workers, you know, over 2,100 are still working from home. So I just, you know, we see you and we see the need for this in the county level, and we know that we just want to get this done. And I appreciate that we're probing this because we want to have accountability. When we keep getting asked for more full-time workers and more things happening, I want to know, because I'm brand new, where is the accountability of things getting done on the DHS side? So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. We're running out of time. Representative Norris, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Norris, and thank the members of the committee for the discussion. It kind of mirrors some of the discussion we had in human services policy. I think there's obviously an opportunity here to dive deeper into how do we improve and innovate around training. This bill is designed to do one pilot program to start to explore that, but I think it's hopefully just the start of a bigger and broader conversation that'll make things better for our county partners, for the state, and then ultimately for the citizens that we're all tasked with serving on a daily basis here in our state government.
Thank you so much, Representative Norris. With that, I renew my motion that House File 2141 to be re-referred to Children and Families Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails. You are on your way to Children and Families. Thank you so much for paying the bill. The last bill on the agenda is House File 895. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee. While you're coming to the testify table, I will move House File 895 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please introduce your bill. I see you have put A1 amendment. I will move A1 amendment. If you can explain the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing the bill today. The A1 amendment simply changes some of the numbers on line 11, page 1, and gets them up to where we'd like to be from where they currently are, which are far too low to cash flow any kind of a facility like this. So that's what the amendment does, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. This concerns a facility in Ortonville called Monarch Heights, and I'm new to the area out there because of redistricting, but I've been so impressed by people that work there and the high esteem that this place is held at by the people who are in Big Stone County in Ortonville. And I'm going to let the administrator take over from here and talk about Monarch Heights. There's kind of a payment disparity that really needs to be looked at here and hopefully corrected, because it's a wonderful place. The folks out there speak so highly of it. And here's my testifier, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stacey Carls, and I'm going to get emotional. I told myself I wouldn't because we're in a hurry, so I won't cry.
Take your time. Don't worry, Ms. Carls.
No, I won't. All right, so I'm the administrator of Monarch Heights. A quick bit about Monarch Heights. We're not just another facility coming to you guys asking for more money, so I'm so sorry, but that just shows that there is a real need for us. But a quick bit about Monarch Heights. We're a nonprofit Class B intermediate care facility. Currently, we have 11 residents. We're at max capacity, and we have a growing wait list. 9 of our 11 residents have called Monarch Heights home for 27 years, and 3 of them just happen to be siblings. Our residents currently range in ages from 21 all the way to 71, so there's a big age, you know, gap. We're not just for elderly individuals, and both male and female. But I could sit and talk to you guys all day long about the amazing care that we provide, the differences that we make, and the lives that we change. And trust me, I would love to tell you guys all those stories, but I won't. I've listened to a lot of these hearings and ICFs asking for rate increases, and I just feel that there's a lot of times really important information that I don't think is getting relayed to you all. So I just want to stress the numbers, clarify, and let that speak for itself. ICFs are classified into 2 groups, Class A, Class B. Class A, less medical needs. Class B, more medical needs, all that. What really, our funding is based on the per diem rate. We're not covered by waivered services. We count on that per diem rate. When you look at the numbers, and I know there was a ton of information that we have for you guys, so sorry about that, but when you look at the numbers, they speak for itself. Class A facilities, their range at the lowest is 119, their highest is 358. That's an average of 215. Monarch Heights, which is a Class B, more medical need, Class B facilities go from $148 all the way to $500. That's an average of $300. Right now, I'm not coming to you as one of the lowest. We are the lowest. $148.10 is what our per diem is. Now, speaking of per diem, it's really important to understand what this per diem means. Like, what do we pay for with this per diem? That's exactly it. The short answer is absolutely everything comes out of this per diem rate. You know, from wages to bills, utilities, furnishings in the house, hygiene, personal care items, food, recreational upgrades, activities, supplies, vehicles, all that. I think something more importantly to look at is that in the past 22 years, our rate has only increased by $33.51. Doing the math, that's $1.52 a year. I'm pretty sure our cost of living has increased by a little bit more than that. So we are still operating on a payment rate that is far too low. And I think someone in another committee kind of stated it best when they said this per diem is a number that, like, someone created 20-some years ago and has really no basis, and it's a magical number. But clearly it's anything but magical for us. What's really important to realize, too, and I just might as well put my papers aside, is that when you look at this rate that we're giving, we basically have the option to say we are going to decrease our care that we give because we don't get paid enough. But who's going to do that? Our care is second to none. I mean, we provide the best care. The real people that are affected are my employees. Sorry. My staff, I can't even do it justice. I apologize.
No, take the time.
Words wouldn't do justice to explain what my staff do. You know, this line of work, it's not easy. It's hard. It's dirty. The real truth of it is my staff have to go without wage increases. That my staff, who work weekends, holidays, evenings, early mornings, our schedules are constantly changing because we don't get snow days, they get left behind. They're showing up. When COVID, when businesses were shutting down, my staff still came in. Who suffers? Not the clients, not our residents, because my staff are amazing, but their families, because my employees work overtime, longer hours, 2-3 jobs to make ends meet in their own life. It's in our county, someone can go to our local gas station and fast food restaurant and earn more than I give my employees. That is not right. We are a medical facility. My staff are medically trained healthcare professionals, and we can offer $11.85 an hour. The average wage in the state is 15. Something has to be done, and I'm just begging you guys to really help me push this along. I mean, I'm annoying, I'm loud, I talk a lot, but I'm not going to go anywhere. We've looked into short-term solutions. People bring up per diems. 20 years we've been fighting this rate. We have exhausted almost every opportunity at a per diem or a variable rate, excuse me, that we can. And we're running out of resources. And this is one of my last-ditch efforts to say, please let us continue to be a home for the 11 individuals that we serve. Let us continue to be a place of employment for my amazing, dedicated staff. And hopefully to serve more in the years to come. We are a great asset to our community. We shop local despite our wage. I mean, we're an hour to the nearest Walmart. So our community would be greatly affected. I know we have a lot of support from the community, but in our county, you know, again, I have all this other stuff to say, but I wanted the numbers to speak for itself. And then when you look at the county map that I gave you guys, where we are in way western Minnesota, $148.10 is our rate. The county directly below us is $236. Above us, $300. South of us, $400. So you can't even blame our low per diem rate on being in rural America. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. It's not magical. I'm just begging you guys, pleading for your help. it's not going to affect the care that we give, but the fact is my staff who have a calling, a desire, they don't have this job for the money, the desire that they have to care for and make a difference for our most vulnerable population, the truth is they can't afford to work for me anymore. And we owe it to the staff that show up when, in today's society, a lot of people aren't showing up, but my staff, they are despite their low wages. So thank you for your time. I know it's the end of the day, or, you know, end of the hearing. You guys are like, get her out of here. But I appreciate everything. If you guys have any questions, I welcome them. But just thank you very much for your time.
Just wanted to say thank you, Ms. House, for the work you do and the caring you do for many vulnerable individuals. So I just wanted to say we appreciate the work you do.
Can I make one comment?
Representative Barker, welcome to the committee. Please.
I started with this bill because Paul, Representative Anderson.
Representative Barker, I think you can pull the chair behind you.
Oh, there it is.
Representative Anderson.
I just will be brief. I know we're running over, but I'm the one that introduced the bill a couple years ago, and all I can say is she's amazing. Their staff is. I know that we see a lot of different things, but they do a lot of great work for their intermediate care. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Any member discussions? Representative Zelesnicka.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative. I'm just thrilled to see that you stuck it out and that you're providing services as a nursing home administrator for 30 years. It's a tough road to hoe, and it never shuts down. It's Christmas or a holiday for somebody every day. And so it's tough to get shift work, and it's tough to build a team in the atmosphere you've had. So congratulations, and our better days are ahead. Thank you.
With that, your closing remarks, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I can't add anything to what you've heard already. I would just say please support House File 895 as amended, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much. With that, I renew my motion that House File 895 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you so much for presenting the bill. Members, we don't have any further agenda items. We're now adjourned. Thank you.